This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 1978, VPR and NPR teamed up to produce a documentary on maple sugaring called Maple Sugar Time. Let's listen as sugarmaker Donald Hazelton of Dummerston Center explains how many taps can be put into a particular tree based on the tree's diameter.
They figure roughly 10 inches for one, and then if they get up 14, you can go two, or you can add about a tap every 4 inches. Then lots of times you know how good the trees are. Real healthy tree can stand the whole number of taps. Other trees like that one, big enough for four or five, but three is good for now. Yeah, it's always a good sound when you can hear the bucket filling up behind you.
That's from our 1978 documentary on maple sugaring. It was around that time, vacuum tubing was just taking hold around that time. Now you see more blue tubes snaking through the forest than silver buckets. And that's not the only change. But in many ways, the tradition remains the same, a cultural touchstone for generations of Vermonters. We're going to take a brief tour through the history of sugaring today. The temps are supposed to warm up a little bit this week, so the sap might get flowing again, just in time for the statewide Maple Open House weekend. Now joining us for our tour are Betty Ann Lockhart, author of Sugarin' in Vermont, A Sweet History, and Burr Morse, owner of Morse Farm Maple Sugar Works in Montpelier. Betty Ann and Burr, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's go all the way back to start, and as back as we can, at least as far back as we know. Betty Ann, you talk in the book a little bit about the Abenaki and how they were tapping trees before settlers came to Vermont. Can you describe that process a little bit?
The process involved using a sharp tool to make a cut in the tree and to channel the sap down into usually a birch bark basket. I think they could hang the birch bark basket on the tree as well. And that was the tapping and the collecting of the sap. From there, they would collect the sap, take it to a large hollowed-out log, and heat stones, a special kind of stone called a grandfather stone, that would not split or break or harm someone, and heat the stone and put it into the sap. Now, it's hard to imagine, but it does work, that you could get enough hot stones to get that sap boiling and boil it down. The Boy Scouts did this down in Bennington years ago. And
so they've tested the theory.
Yeah, they've tested the theory and it worked. They made syrup. Not beautiful syrup.
But the Abenaki didn't stop at syrup at that time anyway, right? They were boiling it all the way down to crystallized sugar so that it could be preserved.
That's true, because without a tight enough basket or vehicle to hold it, they would need to boil it down to sugar. There is some discrepancy about that, though, and I'm not going to get into it. It's too complicated, but the ethnologists think that they couldn't have gotten it to sugar. Mm. However, scientists say they could. And if you look at your container of maple syrup, for instance, if you have a drip on the side and it's in your refrigerator for a while, you're going to have a pretty sweet little bit of maple sugar.
That's right. Yeah, it sort of crystallizes and gets a lot more solid.
Exactly. So they may have used some evaporation as well.
Burr Morse, you come from a long line of sugar makers in Vermont, and you know some of the history as well of sugar making here. Can you talk a little bit about what you know of early settlers and people who came over from Europe to Vermont and took this tradition and ran with it and sort of changed it from the Abenaki tradition?
Sure. I'm a seventh generation Morse sugar maker right here in central Vermont, and so I have every right to know a few things. I would say thanks, Betty Ann, for your input, and I think the reason the term sugaring came about is because they did make it into sugar. way back, at least with the pioneers, their product was sugar. And then sugar from the south, the transportation got better, and sugar started coming in less expensive-wise, and the sugar makers had to come up with a whole new product and made it, boiled it less and made it into syrup. But the term never changed from sugaring to syruping. That's my idea there. But I do know some things about the pioneer days of sugaring, and they didn't bring anything from Europe, I'm sure. They had to acquire the skill here because there wasn't sugaring going on over there. I assume some of them learned it from the Abenakis, and they were a good people, and they shared their sugaring experience with my ancestors.
Well, yeah, when you say your ancestors, seventh generation, I don't know how far back that is. Do you know when your family started sugaring?
Yes. My great-great-great-great-grandfather, James Morse, came up from Massachusetts in the late 1700s and settled in Cabot, Vermont. He did lots of things. He was mainly a tavern keeper, and he was a justice of the peace, the first justice of the peace over there. But we also have fairly good proof that he, you know, and being in this neck of the woods, he made syrup, maybe just on the family level. But his son, James, moved to Calais, just 8 miles above where my place is now, and he was making syrup up there in the early 1800s. And we also have records that my mother was an Aiken from southern Vermont. And on her side, there was Alexander Cathan, who is related to me. And he would be nine generations back from me. He was the first documented, English sugar maker in Vermont.
Wow, I see Betty Ann here in the studio nodding, because Betty Ann, you got all of these documents that you've collected over the years to create this book, Sugarin in Vermont, and so these names are familiar to you. They must almost appear in your mind when you hear Burr talk about them.
That's true, and I was told about Alexander Cathan by someone from down country.
We're talking today about the history of maple sugaring. We are knee-deep in sap, even if the sap is not running outside right now. And listeners, we'd love to know what you know about how it's done, how your family has done it, maybe for as many generations or almost as many generations as the Morse family. You can share your stories with us by posting them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Or call in if you have questions for our guests. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Marion, who posted this sugaring memory on our Facebook page. Back to the land, 1970s, boiling in the evening out by the trees, fresh eggs poached in boiling sap, served with potatoes cooked in the fire, and warmed homemade bread with last year's goat cheese. Amazing. Sap then lugged up to the house to finish on the wood cook stove overnight. Put it all up in jars, enough for the year, and a bit extra just in case. Hard work, but homemade syrup atop homemade goat yogurt. Ooh, nothing better than that, I imagine. So let's talk about sugar on snow, which Marion doesn't talk about, but looking at, you know, boiling eggs and other traditions that go along with sugaring time. Burr Morse, do you know when sugar on snow started?
I really don't know, but it's certainly been around for in my memory. I'm 66, and so my memory takes me back a little over 60 years, and our sugar house at that time was up in Maple Corner in Calais, and those raised donuts and dill pickles and the sugar on snow will never leave my being, you know. They were part of my growing up.
And what is up, though, Burr, with the pickle? The pickle and sugar on snow, where does that come from?
Well, you know, I think they do it in other states where maple syrup is made, but they don't do it right.
Of course not.
They don't add the pickle. And that's a, you know, I credit the Indians for having discovered the art of maple syrup, and then it took some damn Yankee to come along and add pickles to the whole process.
Betty Ann, what do you have to add about that? Because the pickle has always confounded me.
I don't have much to add about the pickle, but I do know that I've read that the native people, the Abenakis, treated their children to sugar on snow, just pouring it on the snow. I mean, snow was a lot cleaner then. And there are illustrations of that at the New England Maple Museum. They were very kind to their children, and trekking them out into a sugar camp where it was pretty cold, they wanted to have the children have something really good. So
this tradition of sugaring parties or a whole group of family and friends gathering at the sugar house, that obviously sounds like we can trace that really far back as well. And you're smiling now when I mention that, Betty Ann.
Because yesterday I found something in a book from the Clark Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And there was a quote from Gleason's pictorial about sugaring off parties. And evidently they were also a way of flirting. That was known. And this says, in 1852, this was written, "Let the Vermont ladies beware, for in such places they may fall in love." So be careful if you go to a sugar house this weekend.
You may fall in love.
Yeah.
Burr, any young romance at the sugaring off parties for you?
Well, yes, of course. Some of it can be my little secret. But I believe Betty Ann's right, and she heard right about that. It's sweet, you know, and that's the basis for all romance. And the pickle, I think, was it did come about because it's sour, and it counters as sweet. So Vermonters, you know, they won't necessarily be moderate in their helpings. They will use they'll have a whole glass full of syrup, and then sugar on snow, they'll just pour it on and pour it on, and that much sweetness, you've got to counter it with a pickle.
You mentioned, Burr, that your mom's family is from a long line of Vermonters as well. Did they bond over maple in their relationship and pass it on down to you and your family?
Yes, I believe the maple did enter, you know, the romance of my parents. My mother came up from southern Vermont to teach. The only job open was in Maple Corner, where my father had been for generations, and a new teacher in town, young sugar maker, get together. And I believe it did start at a sugar on snow party.
No kidding.
the rest is one big sweet story, because they had over 60 years together and four children who all live right still in this part of Vermont and are all connected with maple sugar making.
If you're connected with maple sugar making, you can call and tell us your love story or whatever you want to talk about. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Douglas is calling in from Bellows Falls. Hi, Douglas. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for the gentleman. We're having a pretty crazy year down in Massachusetts where we're boiling. And I'm curious to know what's the latest in the season that or spring he remembers boiling.
Thanks for the call, Douglas. Burr?
Hi, Douglas. I don't personally remember it going into May, but my father always talked about, oh, gosh, don't worry about the season. It can go right into May. And so it does up in this country. I would think in Massachusetts you're not going to ever see May. But, you know, the way things are going this year, and I understand you guys down there are really not started much yet. I think we're hoping for the entire month of April. Last year we went halfway through April, and I do remember years we've gone most of the way through April. So everything's just kind of set back this year, I think. Good old-fashioned winter followed by hopefully a good old-fashioned late sugar season.
Well, and that's the question, right? It's not so much a matter of the start date, but it's how long the season goes will determine whether or not it's a good season for you.
Yes, how concentrated this season is. I think I can safely say we can have a good season in 2 weeks. We're going to be awful tired at the end of those 2 weeks. But if that's what nature gives us, we'll take it.
I understand, too, that you kind of use your birthday as a way to measure the seasons. That you have a birthday coming up, or has it just happened? I'm not going to reveal the date.
No, it was March 16th, Sunday. And I do use it as a kind of a mark. In fact, I talked to the Weather Channel a couple weeks ago, and I all of a sudden announced my birthday to all those people out there because I said, I think they were trying to drum up some the idea that it was too late and we were all in trouble up here. And I said, well, God, not from my standpoint, because half of my 66 years, we've been boiling by my birthday on March 16th, and the other half we haven't, and that's true.
All right, so we have hope this season. A lot of people worried that it's going to be a late season and that might spell disaster, but as you said, it's really a matter of how concentrated the season is, how much time we get in April. So let's all keep our fingers crossed on that. Betty Ann, we've talked a little bit now about some of the traditions that have sprung up around sugaring, and a lot of those are family traditions or sort of insular traditions. When did sugar making around here go from something that families did or that was a part of a subsistence living to an industry?
Well, I think it was an industry way back, as well as being a family tradition. But one of the records by Samuel Williams, who was a Vermont historian way back, said that in the spring of 1794, Cavendish families made 14,080 pounds of sugar. Now, if you think about that, how they were doing it outdoors, and it certainly was an industry, they couldn't eat that much. I don't think their families were that large. So they were using the sugar to barter, to trade for the things that they couldn't make or have for themselves.
Well, and that's solid sugar that they were making. We're talking here about
solid sugar, so it's going down further than syrup.
Yeah, so they must have been tapping a lot of trees.
A lot of trees, in a very primitive way, because still in 1794, the technology was not superior, for sure. They didn't have tubing and vacuum and reverse osmosis. It was an industry. It was an industry almost from the get-go.
Burr, do you see it as something that is akin to the dairy industry in Vermont? I mean, we've seen technological changes that have allowed for even more production over the years. That vacuum tubing certainly upped the production that people were able to get out of the trees. How do you see it as an industry and part of the economic picture of our region?
Well, it's very important to the economy of the region. It brings folks in to the state. As I've said many times, we have no ocean. We have no Disney World. We have the maple image, and that's so important. And it's totally reasonable to get creative with our maple industry and image, and even to the extent of thinking of new ways to get sap out of trees, like this new system of planting trees and cutting them off and taking sap, by way of vacuum right from the whole cutoff section. I have heard some kind of grumbling out and around, and I don't mean to spread any false, reports, but some people are a little concerned that this new system, when put online, could possibly, cause overproduction, and which is already, a threat with all the technology we have now. But to make that even stronger might be to overproduce, and that's what's happened to the dairy industry. So,
and when you talk about this new technology, I mean, specifically, you're also talking here about some headlines that were made this winter from UVM Extension talking about using saplings to extract sugar and extract sap and make sugar, and that could increase production, and you're worried about oversupply?
Well, I think that it's not wrong to consider that it could possibly cause overproduction in the maple industry. The sugar makers are getting bigger in size and maintaining constant in numbers, I believe. And the vacuum that we're all using has enabled us to make a lot more syrup per tree than we did just a few years ago. In fact, in many cases, twice, 100% more. So if we expand on that with the sapling system, I don't think I'm wrong to consider that it could possibly, create some overproduction.
We're talking today about the history of maple sugaring. We're going to keep on this subject, and we'd love to hear your stories. You can share them with us, or you can ask questions of our experts today by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're learning more about our cultural heritage today, talking about the history of sugar making in our region, with Betty Ann Lockhart, author of Sugarin' in Vermont, A Sweet History, and Burr Morse, owner of Morse Farm Maple Sugar Works in Montpelier, part of a long line of sugar makers in Vermont. And you can add your voice to the mix. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts, post your photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Betty Ann, you wanted to jump in. We were talking a little bit earlier, just before the break, Burr was talking about some new technology and new developments and the potential for oversupply, because as we've gotten more advanced, as we've used vacuum tubing, as we're looking at new methods that may be able to use saplings to produce maple sugar and maple syrup, that it's extracting more from the tree, we're making more maple syrup. What about oversupply? But you have some counter arguments as well.
Yes. I want Burr to think about this. If we had an oversupply, we'd have a big marketing challenge, because with that oversupply, we could do benefit to the whole world. The newest information about maple syrup is that it is the sweetener with the most nutrition. And you can find out information about that. I'm not going to go into it, but it has many things that benefit the body. You can go to VMSMA, Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association website, and find out about it, because it really is important. Right now, I'm substituting maple sugar for most of the white sugar that we use. If I want to make a cake, I put in maple sugar. Now, it's expensive, but it's also worth it.
Well, Betty Ann, you're a real booster for maple syrup and the industry. Obviously, it's something that you love as well, having written this book and having just pored over the history of sugar making in Vermont. But Burr, for you, this is also a job. As much as it's a tradition in your family, I mean, this is something that you need to have as a moneymaker.
Yes, you do. And the price rose a few years ago, I believe it was 2007, 30% in that area. So that was a challenge to work through, because the consumer, was thinking, wow, that went up. But I agree with Betty Ann. I wouldn't suggest that it's – I don't want anyone to think I'm suggesting it's wrong to pursue new ideas and do new research and figure out better and more efficient ways to make more of the product. It's a world-class product, and it has certain health benefits, and we want to spread that word worldwide, and we will sell more. We will. So there's a lot of room to grow. I'm certainly don't want to put the wrong word out that woe is us, we're making too much.
We got a note from Ronald in Shelburne, who's sharing a story as well with us about his family. He says, my family has sugared since 1813 in northeastern Ohio. Last year, the Beals family farm produced nearly 500 gallons the old-fashioned way, gathering tank on a sled pulled by horses and boiled by my Amish neighbors. And let's go to Mars, who's calling in from Cabot. Hi, Mars. Go ahead.
Hey. Hello. Burr, thanks so much for Morse Farm. It's a real gift. My family's enjoyed it for years. I wanted to ask two questions. One is, there is a new process of papping sugar maples by crowning them. Basically, you take the young saplings and extract the syrup that way. And I'm curious what the impact of that method might be on just the landscape. I really appreciate our sugar bushes up here. And then second, just in terms of the mythology, does it make a difference if you're boiling with maple wood, or can you do it with natural gas and get the same great flavor?
Mars, thanks for the questions. Mars has a different take on this new technology using saplings. What about the landscaper?
Yeah, thank you, Mars. I'm not so concerned about that. I think there's probably going to be both a traditional way and the modern way at some point. And the modern way is so far off that I don't think any of us should start holding our breath till it comes online. And the beautiful foliage we have in Vermont is not provided by just sugar maples. It's provided by the mixture of soft maples and other hardwoods and soft woods, the contrast. We're always going to have that. This other system, and I don't know much about it, whether it would be turning our grazing lands or our fields over to plantations of these blunt little maple stubs, I don't know. But I'm not concerned about doing away with our affecting our landscape and our foliage. As far as the boiling fuel that's used, we use wood chips at our place. It's been a way we could kind of cheat and get an automatic fuel, but it's still wood. A lot of folks are using oil, and I suppose if natural gas comes more available, that could be used. I don't think the flavor of maple syrup is affected by the fuel that we use or that it started out by using an RO machine. I really don't. I defy people to taste the difference between modern syrup made last season and some that was made 20 years ago.
We got a note on technology and landscape from Diana, who says, I know the tubing makes the production more efficient, but I am concerned about trends to create large mono tree stands to make it easier to harvest sap. This reduces the variety of tree species in Vermont. I'm also saddened to see large wooded glens made into a spider web of tubing. I wonder about the effects on deer and moose populations. And let's go to Jessica calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to ask about models for barter systems. I know that there are local food producers who are now, during high seasons, taking volunteer labor over a day or a weekend or something in exchange for just access to the process, seeing how things work, and usually like a little take-home supply. Do you know of any maple farms that do the same sort of thing?
Jessica, thanks for the call. Betty Ann, do you know of any farms that do that?
I don't.
What about you, Burr?
I don't. We get those requests every year, and we're always so glad to have people come up and they can go out in the woods and enjoy themselves. But the modern ways are kind of specialized, and it's a little hard for someone to just like. You used to go just gather sap, and it was pretty easy. But
yeah, in my experience, Jessica, it's been you got to cozy up to a family that still makes a small amount of maple syrup, and they're usually happy to have you come for a sugaring off party and join in the process and be able to take some home. I imagine those bigger operations, it is harder to sort of slot somebody new in. So find some local people in your area who makes small-scale maple syrup, and maybe they'd take you on.
Good advice.
Betty Ann, you've spent a lot of time looking at the history of maple sugaring in Vermont. You've written a book about it. You have done it a little bit on your own property, just, small scale. What's the fascination for you?
I've never really understood it. It interests me. But I think I understand it better because I had an email from our son last night. And evidently, our family settled in Alberg, Vermont, which I never knew. I thought we were always flatlanders, in probably around the time when Burr's family started doing this. It was the early 1790s or the late 1780s, 1780s. And his name was Gabriel Manning. And they stayed for a while, but they didn't stay long enough. So I can't say that I'm an eighth generation Vermonter.
But the sugaring may be in your blood somewhere.
That's true.
Back there.
Yep, exactly.
The difference between Betty Ann's family and mine is my family was just too darn stubborn to leave.
Well, tradition is a wonderful thing, and certainly looking at new technology that's allowed so many people around the world to taste maple syrup, something that's not just produced in Vermont, but we are sure proud of our product. Burr Morse owns Morse Farm Maple Sugar Works in Montpelier, and Betty Ann Lockhart is the author of Sugarin' in Vermont, A Sweet History. Burr, Betty Ann, thanks so much for celebrating this season with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why adjutants general around the country are angry about proposed Pentagon budget cuts that would reduce National Guard forces by about 10%. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel presented the Pentagon's 2015 budget to Congress. It calls for drastic cuts in military spending. The Army would be reduced to the smallest number of troops since before the Second World War. That would take place over the next several years. And the National Guard would be reduced by about 10%. It's those proposed cuts that have angered Guard leadership. Last week, 50 adjutants general signed a letter to Defense Secretary Hagel protesting the proposed Pentagon cuts. Vermont's Adjutant General Steve Cray was among them, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
The Army has proposed reducing the number of National Guardsmen nationwide, as I said, by about 10%. That would take Guard numbers from about 350,000 to perhaps down to 315,000. Do you have a sense of how that could affect the Vermont Guard?
Well, any cuts to the National Guard is going to have an effect throughout the nation. There are certainly lots of discussion going on right now about how those proposed cuts would affect not only the Guard at large, like you said, 315,000, but how would it translate to individual states? There are, I think, a myriad of different approaches. It could be, sort of a cookie cutter across the board. So all states share about the same, or it could be capability based, where there may be a unit or a capability in a state that the Army says is no longer needed. But we're not.
So are you
there
talking
yet.
About base closures in that case?
Possibly. I don't think necessarily for the National Guard. But if there are units that have to be closed, then it does translate to armories around the states. Those particular units fill and reside out of those armories. So that's certainly possible. Certainly, it's more probable, I guess, if we had to actually go to 315,000. That's a very, very large reduction for the National Guard.
There were some planes that were cut entirely from the Air National Guard's budget in this proposal, but not the F-16, not the F-35. So does that suggest that perhaps Vermont would be spared much of the cuts if you're talking about capability-based cuts?
Yeah. On the Air National Guard, it's a different landscape in the budget cut. It was... the cuts that were in the Air Force were targeted, like you said, at certain systems like the A-10, like some other older legacy models, but not the F-16, which is certainly still needed by the U.S. Air Force, and not the F-35. And actually, the F-35 was one of those programs that stayed by and large whole. Other cuts had to be made. And so I don't see any cuts at all to the Vermont Air National Guard.
Bottom line, in terms of what this means for Vermont, we're not sure.
No,
it is
it's really too early to tell. You had mentioned the letter that the Adjutant General signed 2 weeks ago. A similar letter signed by all 50 governors went to the President of the United States. There are several pieces of legislation in Congress right now that have a lot of support that calls for the same thing. Basically, don't cut the Army National Guard. It is our most economically effective force, especially as we are drawing down the active component. We still need a strong reserve component, and the National Guard is the most cost effective piece of that. And we're actually asking for Congress to commission a study similar to what the Air Force did over the last 2 years to look at the future of what the force structure might look like within the Army National Guard. So those are really the big things. And we just want to express our views to Congress that cutting the National Guard may not be in the best interest of the nation for its defense.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this because, as you said, the adjutants general have gotten together. You have written a letter to Defense Secretary Hagel. You're looking at Congress now to try to maybe put back in some of the budget for the National Guard because Congress has the ultimate say here in what the budget is and where that money goes. Why is it that you think the National Guard, the Army Guard, shouldn't be cut when it looks like across the board the military is going to have to make some cuts? And we're talking about the Army, the active duty Army, cutting as well quite a bit.
Yeah, if you look at historically, especially in post-war times, after World War One or Two, drastic reductions in the Army. Same thing after post-Vietnam. And then there was a buildup during the 80s and the Reagan years, and then it slowly has come back down again. But, you know, the active component can sort of flex in size much easier than the National Guard. 75% of our force is part-time. So to transition a unit from one thing to another is very costly, and it takes a lot of time. The reason the National Guard is so cost-effective for the nation is because they don't transition. We live in those communities. We are experts in those missions. The expertise stays there. The experience stays there, and it gives a place for soldiers that come off active duty to go to the National Guard. So for the nation, you have to have this capability, this underlying foundation, and the National Guard is very cost effective, especially in peacetime.
I'm curious, though, to have you respond to why the Guard is being so vocal about this. And I mean, it seems like almost a very public and rare spat between branches of the military, which we don't see very often. I mean, certainly when we've had members of the Vermont Guard on before, you're all very circumspect when talking about leadership, when talking about plans. There's a lot of respect. And this seems like a fight. I mean, looking at a National Guard press release, you know, you've said that the Army has disregarded the Guard's contributions, has kind of pushed you out of the discussions. You're angry.
We are angry, and it's unfortunate that it has sort of gone beyond the family. But there was a lot of discussion on before, and there's still a lot of discussion going on. And I think it's a respectful debate, really. But the role of the adjutant generals is to be that military official, the expert within the state, to advise the governor on what's happening with their National Guard. And when there are cuts to what we see is not only for a state capability, we certainly don't want to see any reductions within the state, but we also see a reduction in our national capability. It's unfortunate that it's playing out this way, but you're right. You know, go back to what your point is. The Congress has the ultimate say, and part of my job is to advise not only our governor but our congressional delegation on what I think is best for, you know, not only for the Vermont National Guard but what's best for the nation. And in this case, reducing the National Guard, I don't think is the right choice.
Well, what's your argument, though, to Congress that this isn't just the National Guard, as any branch would be saying, "Oh no, just don't cut us"?
Well, because we do have we are economic. So if it's about economics, and some of this is, and some of this is capability, we spent a lot of time and treasure building up the National Guard since 9/11. There's a lot of experience there. To just take it and cut it doesn't make sense economically. In a peacetime environment where it seems like we're transitioning to, the National Guard is the best bang for the buck.
That's Major General Steve Cray. He's Vermont's Adjutant General, and he joined other National Guard leaders in expressing dismay over proposed Pentagon cuts that would reduce Guard troops by about 10% over the next few years. As we've been talking, Congress has the ultimate say on whether or not those cuts go through. General Cray, thank you very much for joining us
today. Thank you.
The town of Vernon had one of the most protracted debates in the state in this month's town meeting day. How to structure the budget in light of the shutdown of Vermont Yankee led to long hours and divided constituents. By a mere 6 votes, Vernon townspeople elected to cut more than $260,000 from the budget for law enforcement and eliminate the local police force. That will leave policing in the town to the Windham County Sheriff's Department. Windham County Sheriff Keith Clark joins us now to talk a little bit about what that might mean for him. Sheriff Clark, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Do you think this is a good idea, if it all comes to fruition, to leave the policing up to your department?
Well, it's not a good idea at the level that it's funded. To go from a full-time police department with a budget of over $300,000 down to a budget of $40,000, thinking you're going to get the same level of policing or the right level of policing is really not the direction they need to go at this time.
You say the right level of policing. As you mentioned, it's about $40,000 is what the townspeople approved. And we'll get into the fact that this is not permanent yet. We're going to have another vote of the townspeople. But how much does $40,000 for law enforcement get people from your sheriff's department?
Approximately 18 hours a week of coverage. So, you know, you're looking at maybe 3 to 3.5 hours a day of just some very basic presence patrols and some traffic enforcement. We would not be able to do major crime investigations or provide significant levels of policing services for the amount that it's currently funded at.
Although if there's an emergency, don't state police have to respond? Whether or not there's a contract with the sheriff's department, wouldn't state police have to be involved if there's an emergency?
Correct. The way the statutes are written is the state police are the primary service providers in the communities that do not have their own policing services.
How much do surrounding towns that contract with you pay? I mean, is $40,000 about the same amount that other towns might be contracting with?
Well, it all depends on the town. Some of my towns are, you know, $4,000 to $6,000 a year. They're just looking for occasional assistance with animal control issues and some traffic enforcement. And I have other towns that contract with me for 40 hours a week at a cost of anywhere from $50,000 to $55,000. So it all depends on what each town wants and what level of service they want me to provide.
So this could be something that Vernon voters ultimately do decide is the level that they want, correct?
Correct. Ultimately, they may say this is what we want. And that, again, is up to the voters. And I've cautioned the town of Vernon and its citizens for a while now to say, be very careful. Just simply because the plant's announced that it's closing does not mean that you still don't have a need for significant policing services. If you drive through Vernon now, you'll already see that there's, you know, a lot of for sale signs on the houses, you know, which indicates that you have a transitional population, transitional workforce as the plant goes into safe store and ultimately is decommissioned. And those are a lot of things that the town of Vernon really needs to consider when it's talking about its policing needs.
So you are concerned that there may be more policing need than the town, as the vote at town meeting day was structured, than the townspeople are considering.
That is true. That is what I believe, that over the next few years, there may actually be a need for more policing, not less.
Well, after that town meeting vote, some Vernon residents did petition for a revote because the original vote was so close. As I said, just 6 people put that above 50%. And also, it was a relatively small number. Only about 230 people attended out of a constituency of more than 1,600 people. So there is a new budget meeting that will be held in April, and the town will have to revote on the entire budget, including the law enforcement budget. If the town does decide to stick with its earlier decision about $40,000 for policing through your department, what will that mean for you? How do you ramp that up?
Well, I would add a position. They would not be able to spend their entire day or week in Vernon. We will support it. We will support whatever the community thinks it needs or wants. You know, if they only want that, you know, $40,000 worth of coverage then I'll provide that. However, I would encourage them to find the level of policing that meets the needs of the community, maybe a little better than that.
And are you likely to be at that next budget meeting? It's going to be held on April 29th to debate the whole budget, including law enforcement. Are you likely to be there to be able to answer questions?
I will be there. I did not attend their first town meeting, even though I knew there would be some discussion about policing. So I felt that was a discussion that the town needed to have with its police department. But given that at the last town meeting, my department was specifically named as a potential contracting or vendor for their policing needs, I will attend the next meeting and answer any questions they may have.
That's Windham County Sheriff Keith Clark. He's been giving us his perspective on the Vernon town meeting vote to eliminate the town's police force and contract with the sheriff's department for law enforcement. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome. If you have any other questions, feel free to give me a call.
We will, absolutely. And that's going to wrap up today's show. Now, tomorrow, if you don't have health insurance, you have less than 2 weeks to sign up for it. On March 31st, the open enrollment period for Vermont Health Connect closes for the year. So if you have questions about the exchange, now's your chance to get them answered. We'll talk with the Commissioner of the Department of Health Access, Mark Larson. You can send those comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for the program tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.